This is a Fox News alert. I'm Lisa Brady. The U.S. military's transgender ban is being lifted. U.S. Defense Chief Ash Carter announcing it moments ago.
The first and fundamental reason is that the Defense Department and the military need to avail ourselves of all talent possible in order to remain what we are now, the finest fighting force the world has ever known.
Carter also says it's the right thing to do and that the reality is that transgenders are already serving. He cites estimates of about 2,500 among the 1.3 million active duty service members. Now they'll be able to get medical care and formally change their gender identification in the Pentagon's personnel system. The overall changes to be phased in over a year. The White House downplaying controversy over what's described as an impromptu airport meeting between former President Bill Clinton and Attorney General Loretta Lynch, who could be faced with a decision on possible criminal charges in Hillary Clinton's email probe.
She certainly understands that investigations should be conducted free of political interference and consistent with the facts.
White House spokesman Josh Earnest moments ago, Lynch says she and the former president talked about his grandchildren and not any matter pending for the department. House Speaker Paul Ryan telling Republican lawmakers to expect a gun-related vote next week.
The pronouncement came during a private conference call with GOP House members. Ryan reportedly says this will be part of a bill designed to prohibit terrorists from being able to get handguns or other high-powered firearms.
Fox Radio's Grinnell Scott. Ryan saying the goal is to help stop radicalization of terrorists in the U.S. A new Indiana law that bans seeking abortions over genetic issues has just been blocked by a federal judge. The ruling grants a preliminary injunction. Fox News Radio, fair and balanced.
The Republicans, the Democrats, two critical conventions, and only one network covers it all. Fair and balanced. Fox News Channel, starting July 18th, the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, Ohio. Then, starting July 25th, the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The must-see political events are on Fox News Channel. We are America's election headquarters.
Weeknight, Kelly brings the heat.
Developing tonight, a Kelly File exclusive. This is breaking news. We're just getting this.
Inside today's most explosive stories.
That's not the way it was supposed to go down.
Getting answers and challenging the status quo.
Sure, it's a back and forth. I'm not just going to give you the platform for a soliloquy.
Don't come on here and spit. I will leave that to you to decide.
Powerful, insightful, fair, and balanced. Megyn Kelly taking prime time to the next degree.
Join me for the Kelly File, weeknights at 9.
Recapping the breaking news from the Pentagon, transgenders will be allowed to serve openly in the U.S. military. Defense Chief Ash Carter just announcing the lifting of the transgender ban, calling it the right thing to do, but also citing recruitment needs. A rally outside Turkey's Atatürk Airport. Demonstrators chanting against violence after Tuesday's triple suicide bombing, now blamed for at least 44 deaths. A senior Turkish official says the attackers were from Russia, Uzbekistan, and Kyrgyzstan.
This is 13 people have been arrested in Istanbul on suspicion of being linked to the violence. Four of them are foreign nationals, according to state-run Anadolu News Agency. Nine others were detained in the coastal city of Izmir on suspicion of having links to ISIS.
Fox Radio's Jessica Gallagher has still no claim of responsibility for the airport attack. One country comes off a list of human traffickers.
The State Department took Thailand off its human trafficking blacklist, though forced labor is still widespread in the nation's seafood industry. It came as part of the department's annual Trafficking in Persons report. Secretary of State John Kerry called human trafficking modern-day slavery.
That still today claims more than 20 million victims on any given time. And all 20 million are people, just like everybody here.
He says the report is an attempt to bring public attention to the full nature and scope of the $150 billion human trafficking industry. Tanya J. Powers, Fox News.
Some of the older cars with recalled Takata airbags have a bigger chance of airbags exploding in a crash, up to 50%. The U.S. government now warning drivers of Hondas and Acuras from the 2001 to 2003 model years not to drive them except to get the recalled airbags replaced. Wall Street, a rally again. The Dow's up 194. I'm Lisa Brady, Fox News Radio.
Welcome back. What matters in North Carolina? You have found the right place. You are in the right spot. My name is Mark Shiver. The next 2 hours, we're going to bring you the latest in all of the information that you need about what is going on in North Carolina and all that matters in our great state. It's Thursday. We're gearing up for a big extended weekend as we celebrate Independence Day on Monday. And I hope that your plans are going according to schedule and that you've got a big weekend planned with your friends and family. By the way, you can follow us on Twitter at What Matters NC, and you can engage with us there. We'd love to hear from you and answer any questions that you may have, any comments you'd like to make, at What Matters NC. And also you can tweet at me at Mark Shiver. Well, the General Assembly has agreed on a budget, and they are debating that even as we speak. The Senate got their stuff done yesterday. The House will be going through their motions today. And there's a lot to talk about regarding education. And as always, one of the best people in the whole state to talk to about education and the education budget is Brenda Berg. She's the CEO of Best NC. Brenda, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Well, I trust that you are pleased with the education budget or not so much?
I think it's a very solid education budget, definitely all around. It's well balanced between different priorities that are important. Of course, teachers got a big boost, but also focusing on literacy, looking at textbooks and resources. So, yeah, I think it's a solid budget.
Our guest is Brenda Berg of Best NC here on at What Matters in North Carolina. The Senate, as you remember, had come out with quite a robust, aggressive teacher pay proposal. The House and the governors were a little bit more closely aligned. But at the end of the day, an average 4.7% is not too bad.
Not too bad at all. And what's really important there is the structure of it. So it was more the dollar amount of the House and the governor, but it was the structure of the Senate plan. So what we're looking at is basically the Senate plan rolled out over 3 years instead of two, which is a real win for educators to be able to see really where the pay structure is going over several years, assuming that the economy cooperates.
Exactly. Well, can you explain for our listeners that may not be as up to date on this sort of thing? You say the Senate had some goals that were to take place in 2 years, but actually they're going to take place in three. Just kind of break that down a little bit more if you can.
Okay, I'm going to go backwards and then go forward. So 3 years ago, it took a teacher 32 years to get a $50,000 base salary. Now that's before benefits, local supplements, but a minimum of $50,000. The Senate plan would get a teacher there at their 15th year of experience. So really halving how long it takes you to get to that place, which is really best practice for any profession, that you should be gaining your greatest professional pay increases earlier in your career. So the Senate really put a stake in the ground saying we want teachers by their 15th year to get to this place that used to take 30 years to get to. Their plan was to roll out over 2 years, and then the final budget really took their plan but rolled it out over the next 3 years, so this year and the following two-year budget cycle.
Our guest is Brenda Berg, who is very smart, but also able to let people like me understand what's going on. So she's explaining to us and commenting on the Senate House agreement on the budget regarding education. So have you talked with educators, teachers? Is the verdict pretty positive about this budget and the pay increase?
Yeah, I haven't heard a lot of negative, which is sort of what where you're looking for is who's not happy about this. I think one thing that was resolved in the House and the Senate side that neither had really addressed was teachers with 25-plus experience weren't getting anything in either of the budgets, and here they actually got some money. And I think that calmed some of the concerns of the more veteran teachers. They actually saw a $1,000 pay increase from what I can see. So I think that we have something that's well-balanced where everyone's getting a little bit, but really front-loading the pay schedule, so our beginning teachers are getting rewarded earlier in their career. So I haven't heard a lot of grumbling. I think where you get a little tension is actually something that you see actually throughout the budget, which is differentiated pay. So you're starting to see progress towards thinking about paying a teacher more if they work in a hard-to-staff subject or a hard-to-staff school. So if you think of it as a build, right, we talked about $50,000, but what if you made more because you worked in a high-poverty school and a little bit more because you taught math or another subject that's hard to staff? So that's the part where I think people start to get, you know, wondering how we're going to get that done. And that was another exciting part about the budget is you see a lot of different pilots considering those options.
Our guest is Brenda Berg of Best NC. You're listening to What Matters in North Carolina. Correct me if I'm wrong, but there was some money for in the Senate budget for principals. Is that correct? And how did that flush out or end up in the final budget?
Yeah, about $8.5 million for school-based administrators. That's principals and assistant principals. It works out to 1.5% pay increase. And I believe there's another 0.5% bonus on top of that. So it's good. What's the other part that's good is that both the House and the Senate agree that we need to study the principal schedule. Our principals are actually paid 50th in the nation. So the amount matters, but also the structure of how we're rewarding principals to stay in the school that's their best fit is something that they're going to put some serious consideration between now and the end of the year. I think that's a real win for principals and, frankly, for the teachers that they work with.
Well, Brenda, let's shift gears from the money side of things to one thing that kind of alarmed or some of the people on the left and maybe was greeted with great joy by conservatives is $35 million for opportunity scholarships. Now, when I worked down there and this program was initially rolled out, I didn't see it as something that was going to really grow quickly but would be more eased into. But apparently, that's a lot of money, and it says to me that there's quite a demand out there in the general public for opportunity scholarships. Is that the right way to interpret this?
Yeah, and I think, if I remember, that's non-recurring money. That's one-time money. So it's for the reserves. So if you think about a student who's coming into a school with a voucher this year, well, of course, they're going to say they're in first grade this year. They go to second grade next year. That means that nobody else can come into the pipeline. So I think that's the thinking behind that. And there is a big demand for the program.
Well, how do you feel about that? How does Best NC look at the Opportunity Scholarship Program?
You know, I think we're taking a wait and see. We really look at more systemic issues, like if we're paying all of our teachers better or recruiting them better into the pipeline. Every school benefits, whether it's public, private, charter schools. So we're less focused on the voucher issue, but I am. We are very interested in the accountability factor and making sure that any student that's receiving public dollars, whatever school they're going to, that there's a level of accountability. And I think that's something that we are taking a wait and see and watching carefully. It's very, very important that all of our public monies are being used wisely.
Well, I would certainly concur with that. In a resounding manner. Our guest is Brenda Berg. She's the CEO of Best NC. Let's just stay right there for just a moment. Do you feel like there is good accountability in terms of the public school system right now, or is that something that is just beginning to get momentum?
I think we see accountability at different levels in different places. The school letter grade is an issue that also came up in the budget. They kept what they call the 15-point cuts in the how they give letter grades for schools. A school can get an A or a B or a C or a D or an F, but there are only two factors that are being considered. It's how much student achievement of that school and then how much student academic growth those students are making. Both of which are important. We want to make sure that all of our students are growing and progressing, but we also want to make sure that they're at least on track for career and college readiness. And one of the questions we have going forward and looking ahead toward next year is how can we expand that thinking beyond just these two achievement factors, but what other factors could be used for accountability? And that's a conversation I think that we're seeing statewide on how do you balance those two factors and what other factors might we consider that are important for the public to know about our schools?
Well, our guest is Brenda Berg here in What Matters in North Carolina. She's the CEO of Best NC. From the standpoint of teacher assistance, it looks like we're keeping the level of funding that the budget had allocated in the long session.
Yep. Still are actually. Last year they actually added money. I think that was a little known fact. They actually added money last year that continued this year.
So you feel good about that?
You know, I think it's a conversation to be had. I think TAs are important. They serve an important role. I think that the Senate's question about whether or not we want more licensed teachers in K-3 classrooms and whether or not that can have a bigger impact on literacy is an important one to consider. And one thing they did win in the budget is a $27 million investment in reducing first grade class size. So I think there is more conversation to be had about what is the highest, best use of those positions as TAs. I think we can all agree, especially in those younger grades when you have little ones, having one teacher for 25 students or 20 students is not acceptable. But our allotments are way lower than that. They're in the 17, 18 student per teacher range. So why aren't we actually seeing that when you actually walk into the classroom, and how can we do better? So that, it's an important conversation. I think it will continue beyond this year.
Brenda, what, and maybe I don't want to put you on the spot to get into political stuff, but it seems to me that particularly in K-12, the state is allocating over $8 billion across the state. By anyone's standard, $8 billion is a lot of money, but we continuously hear things, and I know that there are those who will use emotional rhetoric and dramatic words to describe the General Assembly if they don't particularly like the party that's in the majority. But I read things like the dismantling of public education, the destruction of public education, but $8 billion plus is a lot of money, and I'm not really sure how anybody with a straight face can say that that is dismantling public education.
$8 billion is a lot of money. We do have a lot of kids, so you have to think of average per pupil, and we have about 1.5 million children just in the K-12 system. If you look at averages from state to state, I just don't think those are fair comparisons. I think there are states that spend way more money than we do, and they spend it badly. There are states that spend about as much as we do, and they also spend it maybe worse than we do. There was an interesting report from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce that actually gives North Carolina an A for return on investment. So there's how much money we're spending, and then there's how well we're spending the money we spend. And the good news is we get an A for the return on investment of how we're spending that $8 billion, which to me bodes well that as we are making more investments, we're investing, you know, over $200 million more just in personnel this year. I feel very comfortable that we're going to spend that money wisely, especially when you look at the priorities in this budget where you're really prioritizing high-quality personnel, you're prioritizing literacy, and you're prioritizing digital learning and resources. So I don't think anyone would begrudge a financial investment in education as long as we know that it's going to the right priorities.
Absolutely. Brenda, maybe you haven't thought about this yet because we're just winding down this session, but have you thought about board members' retreat maybe in October where you begin to lay out your legislative priorities? What do you think is still a priority that Best NC is going to be banging the drum for in the next session?
No question, we are going to continue focusing on elevating educators. I think we've seen last year, this year, and actually the year before, continuous investment, not just in dollars put into it, but in real thought leadership and in our educators. And we need to accelerate that, continue that movement forward. One thing we focused on a lot this year is principal preparation. As we look ahead next year, we'll be looking at that principal pay schedule, opportunities for differentiated pay for teachers, opportunities for teachers to take on teacher leadership positions. And again, these are systemic issues that if we can really tackle them at the state level, every single school in the state, again, public, private, public charter, every school will benefit from having the best educator pipeline in the country. And that's going to take years. This isn't something that gets solved in one session, but that will be our priority between now and then.
Well, sounds good to me. Brenda, you are doing an awesome job. Thank you, as always, for being our guest here on What Matters in North Carolina. And I encourage you to keep up the good work and keep holding the feet of the General Assembly to the fire and making sure we have the best education we can here in North Carolina.
Thanks, Mark.
All right. There you go. That's Brenda Berg. She's the CEO of Best NC and knows a lot about education, really passionate about teachers and elevating them, as she said, and trying to get the most that we can for those that are in the teaching profession and get the most out of them as well. We're going to take a quick break here. We will be back in just a moment. You're listening to What Matters in North Carolina on the Freedom Action Network.
What you think you know about big money in North Carolina politics is about to change. The most powerful force in Tar Heel politics and government is a shadowy network of activist groups funded by a wealthy liberal elite. The Z. Smith Reynolds Foundation, founded by the heirs of the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company fortune, funds a dizzying array of radical causes and organizations in North Carolina. Most North Carolinians think that the Z. Smith Reynolds Foundation funds parks and hospitals. But in recent decades, it's taken a hard turn left, funneling tens of millions of dollars a year into groups that lobby against the death penalty and for gun control, amnesty for illegal immigrants, Common Core, and extreme environmental policies. That's not all. According to a leaked memo from a group established by Z. Smith Reynolds called Blueprint NC, these groups are involved in coordinated attacks on North Carolina's free market economy and elected leaders. The memo urged activists to cripple their leaders, eviscerate the leadership, and weaken their ability to govern. Organize a staff of video trackers to follow the targets. This shadowy network of groups, funded by Z. Smith Reynolds and other liberal organizations, wields an alarming amount of power in the media, state politics, and government. North Carolina citizens should know more about these groups and how much money is being spent on its radical agenda. To find out more, visit the new website mappingtheleft.com. The site reveals the shocking web of more than 100 left-wing activist groups controlled by Z. Smith Reynolds and other liberal funders in North Carolina.
There is liberty in beer. Finally, a show that ties economics, philosophy, and regulations with the brewing industry. You would be surprised at how laws affecting the craft beer industry have huge effects all over North Carolina. Join the Free to Brew Show Saturdays at 1 p.m. with me, your host, Greg Polscher, where we dive into topics on distribution, ABC sales, federal and state laws, and even beer sports all over your favorite pint of beer. Find out how the seemingly progressive idea is dependent upon the ideas of liberty, capitalism, and property rights to ensure its survival and longevity. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Free to Brew NC. You can't have beer without liberty, and you can't have liberty without beer.
Welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver. So glad to have you listening today and getting excited. It's the last day of June, and we will be enjoying a long weekend. Hopefully you will be as we celebrate the Independence Day. Everybody calls it 4th of July, but Independence Day falls on the 4th of July, and we're celebrating the birth of our great nation. So I'm looking at CarolinaPlotHound.com right now, and at the very top of the big headline above the Plot Hound, it says, Shiver, colon, hacking away at the First Amendment. And I sat down and wrote an article about the ridiculous microaggression list that the University of North Carolina's faculty forum had posted on it. And of course, the university issued a statement saying, well, this was not an official formal or informal policy. The employee forum has, we allow people to post there. And so somebody had posted that you shouldn't say things like, wow, nice shoes, to a female coworker. Because what you're really saying is all you are worth is the leather surrounding your feet. Your intellect is non-existent, and so on and so forth. These are called microaggressions. And so as I read that article about that a couple of days ago, and there were things like, don't tell people that you're going to go play a round of golf, because not everyone can play this expensive and inaccessible sport. And please don't say Merry Christmas, because not everybody is a Christian. So what we have here, and what I wrote about, is an effort on the part of an education elitist to try to begin to harness speech and hack away at the First Amendment. And if you'll notice on the CarolinaPlotHound.com, by the way, excellent website. You should bookmark it and go to it often to stay up to date on what's going on in North Carolina. But you can click on a link that says to the collegefix.com, UNC to host microaggression forum even after removing misconstrued microaggression list. So it wasn't enough for them to make a statement saying this is not our position. It wasn't enough for them to have the microaggression post removed. No, we're going to have a forum. So as I wrote in this article here, that this is just the beginning. This isn't going away, because they said in their statement that this issue needs to be examined and nuanced. And what they're saying is, we don't necessarily disagree with the whole notion of reining in people's speech, the whole notion of harnessing speech. We just are trying to get the egg off of our face that one of our faculty forum posters did this before we had a chance to make it official policy. And the whole social media world laughed at us for several days. So what we're going to do is, we're going to have the Office of Diversity and Multicultural Affairs, the Center for Faculty Excellence, and the College of Arts and Science are hosting a microaggression symposium in August. And I believe it's called Thinkposium. Thinkposium. And they will explore language, behaviors, policies, and practices that impact the classroom, workplace, and educational experiences for students and faculty and staff at Carolina. The discussions and keynotes should help them reflect on their own practices, understand the concepts and behaviors that perpetuate oppression of marginalized identities. What the heck does that mean? And be part of facilitated conversations to develop capacity and skill to address the issue with their own units and departments. So right here, folks, right here. And what did I tell you in the very article that I wrote today and that is at the top of CarolinaPlotHound.com? I said to you that the fact that they took this statement down means nothing. I said, it's all well and good, but hidden in the statement is this nugget. The blog post reflects the opinions of some employee delegates, not intended to provide a general overview about microaggressions. Not till we fully examine the topic, which is nuanced and complex. And so this is what I said. Herein lies the truth about how they really view the topic. There are, in fact, microaggressions. The topic is complex, and we will be examining this. And my question to you is, after further examination, will we once again be instructed to no longer compliment people on their nice new shoes? I mean, folks, if I like your shoes, I feel like I should have a right to say I like your shoes. I mean, is that really such a bad thing? We'll talk more about this in just a few minutes, but we're going to take a quick break, get you caught up on your Fox News, and hopefully nobody will be offended while we're gone. You're on the Freedom Action Network. No microaggression here, folks. This is what matters in North Carolina. Be right back.
Lisa Brady. The U.S. defense chief says the reality is that transgenders are already serving in the U.S. military.
They've deployed all over the world, serving on aircraft, submarines, forward operating bases, and right here in the Pentagon.
Now they'll be able to serve openly. Fox Radio's Grinnell Scott has this live.
Lisa, Defense Secretary Ash Carter says the ban is lifted immediately, and transgender individuals will be actively able to enlist in the ranks a year from now. He says that will add to transgender numbers who wear the uniform today.
Although relatively few in number, we're talking about talented and trained Americans who are serving their country with honor and distinction.
The process includes getting medical care to establish gender identity by October. Carter announced last year that the ban would be lifted, Lisa.
Thanks, Grinnell. The White House says the U.S. Attorney General knows how to be impartial. This amid controversy over what's being called an impromptu meeting between Loretta Lynch and former President Bill Clinton on his private jet at a Phoenix airport Monday, even as Hillary Clinton's emails remain under federal investigation.
I did not attend the meeting, but Attorney General Lynch did, and she's spoken directly to how the meeting came about and what was discussed.
White House spokesman Josh Earnest. Lynch says she did not discuss any matters pending for the department. The U.S. State Department just confirming that a 13-year-old Israeli girl fatally stabbed in her bedroom in the occupied West Bank today was a U.S. citizen, the assailant climbing a security fence and entering that home. Late word from Hershey that its board has unanimously rejected a takeover bid from Oreo maker Mondelez. Hershey also saying there's no basis for further discussion. Hershey shares had been soaring on word of that offer. An hour to the close, Wall Street going for three in a row. The Dow is up 220 points. Fox News Radio, fair and balanced.
Real experience, real insight.
We're following this explosive story.
Nothing gets by Greta. Then.
This is all BS. What was that all about?
There's no spin and no question. O'Reilly dominates. Plus, smart, sharp, and cutting edge.
It's the news of the day, but with a little heat.
Megan delivers. And Sean seals the deal with fearless talk.
What part of that are you understanding?
Most watched. Most trusted. Fox News Channel. There's more to Fox News Radio than meets the ear. Go behind the headlines and join the conversation on the hottest stories of the day on the Fox News Radio Facebook page. Be a part of the Fox News Radio Facebook fan community. Post comments and tell us your opinions. See behind-the-scenes photos and videos and post your reactions to the stories that matter to you. Click the like button on Facebook and connect with breaking news and features like Fox in the Fast Lane, House Call for Help, and more. Go to Facebook.com/Fox News Radio.
Security forces raiding neighborhoods in Istanbul looking for suspects linked to ISIS. There's still no formal claim of responsibility for the Tuesday attack at Ataturk Airport that's now blamed for at least 44 deaths. This as U.S.-led airstrikes pound ISIS targets in Iraq.
U.S. military officials tell Fox a series of airstrikes by American and Iraqi jets have killed nearly 250 ISIS fighters in the past 2 days. The strikes against ISIS in Iraq began 1 day after the Istanbul bombings. The strikes came as a convoy of ISIS fighters fled the city of Fallujah, located 40 miles west of Baghdad. Fallujah was the first city to fall to ISIS in 2014. 55 ISIS trucks in all were destroyed, killing hundreds of ISIS fighters south of town. U.S. and Iraqi airstrikes also destroyed over 100 ISIS vehicles east of Ramadi, killing scores of additional ISIS fighters. At the Pentagon, Lucas Tomlinson, Fox News.
A security scare at Joint Base Andrews that turned out to be a false alarm.
A person inside a medical building on base saw something and said something, prompting the false alarm. The person who called 911 was not aware two people with long guns outside the window were security personnel. The base was put on lockdown and employees were told to shelter in place. About an hour later, the all clear was given.
Fox Radio's Rachel Sutherland. Joint Base Andrews says given the nature of the call, it had to be treated as a real response. It was also on the opposite side of the base from where a planned active shooter drill was scheduled, which further led officials at first to believe it was a real-world situation. The nation's oldest full-time park ranger gets attacked and robbed in her own home. Police in Richmond, California say 94-year-old Betty Reed Soskin was punched in the face several times in a late-night attack Monday. Among the items stolen, a coin given to her by President Obama when she lit the national Christmas tree last year at the White House. Soskin works as an interpretive ranger at a Rosie the Riveter historic park in the Bay Area. Fox News Radio.
Welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver. Glad to have you listening on this Thursday. Hope you're excited about the Independence Day weekend. And really, there is no one better in the state when it comes to investigative reporting. Nick Oxner with BTV. Welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina.
Hello, Mark. How are you?
Good. I take it you're a tad busy.
I am. I'm standing right now down the street from you in the legislative building. We're awaiting Senate President Pro Tem Phil Berger. So if I have to step out of this interview for a second, it'll be because I have to interview Senator Berger. But happy to be with you now while we wait.
Well, if he does come out, just hold the phone up and we'll get two for the price of one.
There you go.
So first of all, let's talk about, you were the darling of social media for about a day and a half with HB2. Apparently, you were given a copy of the Republican, quote, tweak. And tell us about all that and what's true and what's not as far as what went down and where we stand on that right now.
Well, that's a big, big question. How about where we stand on that right now? I'll start with that. Right now, we're kind of in limbo, waiting to see what either chamber will do with this legislation. You know about as much as I do is in terms of whether or not either house will actually take up the proposed legislation. Of course, the copy of the bill that we posted on Tuesday was the first time that most members of the General Assembly, Republican or Democrat, had seen that legislation. It caught many by surprise. And then after a caucus yesterday, a joint caucus that included a visit from Governor Pat McCrory, House Republicans distributed a updated version of the legislation with some minor tweaks on it. And now, of course, Governor McCrory met today with some Democratic Senate and House members, and some Senate Democrats seem to think that this will get a vote. That remains to be seen.
Well, in terms of all of the hubbub and all of that, I mean, how did that get so out of hand? Because really, you didn't really contribute to it from what I saw. I guess that's just social media, huh?
All we did was posted a copy of some proposed legislation.
Yeah, and then go from there, right? Exactly.
That's right.
So, by the way, Senator Sam Bingham just receiving the order of the longleaf pine. I'm sure you're aware of that, and
we can hear the clapping from outside the chamber.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm sure Senator Tillman will have something funny to say, but we're talking with Nick Oxner, investigative reporter with WBTV. So, in your gut, I mean, you said I know as much as you do, but in your gut, I mean, you've been doing this a long time, Nick. What do you think? Are we going to get a tweak, a big tweak, a minor tweak, no tweak? Because I'll tell you what I think. I think the Senate is dug in, and we're not going to get any tweaks. That's my opinion, but you can prove me wrong or tell me I'm wrong.
I'll tell you that it seems to be the most of the work to offer this legislation, to draft the legislation. Most of that momentum is coming from the House side.
Right.
I'll say that. And so if I had any bets, I'd say we'd see it in the House before we saw it in the Senate. But
right.
At this point, given the surprised and unfavorable reaction in the House from most of the House rank and file Republicans, I'm not sure that the leadership will want to bring that legislation to the floor in their chamber either.
Well, yeah, I mean, you make a very good point. So Governor McCrory, can you tell us anything about his meeting with Democratic senators?
Yeah, from the Democratic members that I've talked with today, you know, I'm not sure that meeting was groundbreaking by any stretch of the imagination. As I understand it, that didn't go into many details. It didn't cover much specific ground. I think many of the members seem to have kind of walked out of there with a shrug.
Huh. I'm kind of scratching my head as to why he did that if there wasn't going to be anything substantive. Anything you'd like to opinionate in that regard?
Well, it might be a sign that if this is going to get to the floor of either chamber, they know that they need Democratic support in order to pass it, given the, you know, skepticism that's been voiced or the outright opposition that's been voiced by some Republican members. So it could be a show of good faith, or show that they need to get some of these Democrats on board with this specific proposal.
Our guest is Nick Oxner, and he is with WBTV, investigative reporter. Now, Nick, you've also been doing some other work down there. And of course, the HB2 has sort of taken up a lot of your time. But in the middle of all of that hubbub, Senator Fletcher Hartzell was indicted. And I thought it was fascinating that he, I believe he chaired a committee meeting and then went and turned himself in.
Well, I think that just goes to show you how little of a surprise this came. I mean, I think there's still a big difference in expecting one of your members to get indicted and having one of your members indicted. But, you know, this is a process that's been played out over, you know, the past year plus. And I think that Senator Hartzell has maintained, you know, his belief that he has not committed any crimes. So I think he's trying to face this, as head on as he possibly can.
Well, Senator Hartzell has been already been calls for his resignation during this time of being indicted. Obviously, he's not running again. Would it mean anything for him to resign here in what is almost July, or just kind of, you know, fade away? I mean, what's the point in appointing someone to replace him for 5 months?
It would probably, at this point, probably be more effort to appoint someone than it is to just let him serve out the last few months of his term. You know, and the Senate just filed their bill to get out of here at the end of the week. So, you know, effectively, the Senate's work is nearly done for this session, for all intents and purposes. And so I'm sure that is the thought of Senator Hartzell. I don't know. I've not spoken with him.
Yeah.
But that would make sense to me.
Well, and the bulk of the work, not to diminish the role of the members at all, but the bulk of the day-to-day work and constituent service is in the hands of the legislative assistants and the staff. So that should not be affected greatly. You know, life will go on when people call his office and need help. So the people there, I'm sure, will continue to provide that assistance. We're talking with Nick Oxner, and he is an investigative reporter. No one in North Carolina like him or doing what he does. And we appreciate his time with us here on What Matters in North Carolina. So big doings on WBTV regarding coal ash. And you are right square in the middle of that. Tell us about it.
Who's surprised that I'm right square in the middle of a big issue? Yes. Tonight, as a matter of fact, we have an investigation airing on WBTV at 6 o'clock that has everything. We've been working on it for a number of months, but it is directly tied to legislation that moved through the Senate earlier this week, and it's set to be voted on by the House today. I think the House is in session right now, so it could have already voted on it for all I know. I've been on the other side here. But anyway, so this new legislation would require Duke Energy to provide alternative sources of water to residents living within a half-mile radius of their coal ash ponds. And then it gives DEQ the ability to determine that additional homes are affected by the coal ash ponds and that Duke needs to provide them water, too. It remains to be seen what criteria DEQ is going to use to make those determinations. We did our own tests of wells around the Cliffside steam station, which has a lot of coal ash in its coal ash ponds and has a lot of coal ash on its property. It's an old plant. So we did our own test of 6 water wells between about a half mile and a mile and a half from the Cliffside plant, and we found of the 6 wells we tested, 4 of them had elevated levels of hexavalent chromium, which is a toxic chemical associated with coal ash.
Huh. Did you let the people who are drinking that water know?
Yes, we did.
And were they?
And we let the 2 know that had lower levels too.
And were the ones that did have the elevated levels, were they happy about that?
Well, certainly not. I mean, all the neighbors in the area. We started our investigation because the whole area of neighbors out there had concerns that their water may be contaminated. That concern was sparked largely because their neighbors down the street had some of their neighbors in their area had gotten letters from the state saying, do not drink your water. It has elevated levels of hexavalent chromium, because they were within the 1,500-foot radius from the coal ash pond. But other neighbors did not have their water tested, and so they didn't know. And so they said, well, the best guess that we have is that it is, you know, does contain elevated levels of hexavalent chromium. And so they called us, and that's why we decided to pay for our own tests. We contracted with the same lab that did the state tests, and that's what we found.
Wow. That would have to be disturbing. I mean, right after getting that news, you kind of, you know, you go to the kitchen and run that glass of water and you're thinking, nah, maybe I'm not that thirsty.
No, I think I'd run to the food line and pick up a case of Deer Park.
Exactly. So the House is beginning their budget debate now, and the Senate should be winding up any second now. So I know we may lose you momentarily, but what do you think will come of this amazing report that you guys are going to air? I mean, it's a little late to change the legislation, is it not?
Well, the legislation still provides an avenue for DEQ to decide that more houses are affected by coal ash. And so the real rub comes that Duke Energy says that no wells near their plants are affected by the coal ash buried underneath the ground, much of which is seeped into the water table. That is Duke's position. The position of environmentalists is that the science that Duke is relying upon to make those claims is flawed, and we get into that some in our piece tonight, and that this is something that they really need to take a look at.
Well, when you say it's flawed, I mean, how do you say, I mean, obviously you would have a source or a resource or another scientist that would be able to make that kind of judgment or assertion.
Yes, the Southern Environmental Law Center, who's suing several people over involving coal ash. But anyways, they hired a hydrogeologist who points out some specific flaws with the methodology of Duke's models and with the sample data of the water wells that Duke has.
Okay. So,
and I could get into that more, but neither you. Well, you might be a chemist. I'm not, or a geologist or a scientist, but I'm not. So I'll leave it to the experts.
No, I went to school in South Carolina, Nick, so there's no chemistry here. our guest is Nick Oxner here on What Matters in North Carolina, and doing really the work of about 12 people, it seems like, for WBTV. And
my boss is to give me the paycheck of 12 people.
Exactly.
That'd be great.
Well, you certainly deserve it. What else is on your plate, or is that enough? Let me ask you this. When they roll out of the Senate, and maybe they do go sine-die end of session for this session, what will you be doing? Will you be covering the adjournment? Will you be just listening on your computer, or is there more to do here in Raleigh for you regarding that?
There's always more to be done in Raleigh, and we continue to have a number of projects on our plate. I think an interesting thing that'll keep us busy after the session adjourns is looking at the campaign finance reports from all of the members that are due here in a couple weeks, so we'll see what's in those. I don't know yet, obviously, because I don't have them, and I don't have any specific plans, but I'm just saying that is something we'll look at. And then, of course, I don't know if you know, but we have an election coming up.
Really? Imagine
so
that.
Those always, yeah, right. So those always, you know, I'm sure there will be many issues that come out of that that we'll be paying attention to as well. So even after these folks go home for the year, I think there could still be much to do.
Well, Nick, we appreciate all that you're doing. I'm going to let you go so you can get ready for the Senate adjournment. I know you want to track down Senator Berger. But thank you, as always, for your time here on What Matters in North Carolina. And please keep up the excellent work.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
All right. There you go, folks. Nick Oxner. And I used to be one of those guys standing around frantically waiting for the gavel to drop and for the lieutenant governor to say that they are adjourned. And then you kind of hustle in and stand around a group of four or five other people waiting to get a word from someone like Senator Berger. And to his credit, he's always been very nice to the media. I think he was to me. He always talked to me whenever I would stand around and wait. Sometimes I had to wait longer than I wanted to, but Senator Berger always nice to me and to the media and willing to talk and make statements, and we appreciate that. In fact, he's a friend of this program, and I would expect him to be making an appearance on What Matters in North Carolina, hopefully in the next couple of days, if not, then after Independence Day. But we certainly will be talking with House Speaker Tim Moore later on in the program. He's another friend of the program, and we appreciate his willingness to talk to us. I mean, folks, he didn't have to do that. Let me just say this. They are busier down there than you can imagine. I have been there. I know what it's like. It's a zoo right now in the General Assembly because they're trying to finish and there's so much to be done. There are committee meetings and there's other meetings and people wanting your time. And, well, Speaker Moore, can't we do this? And what if we did that? And then he's got to preside over the session, which the budget debate just started in the House. And so for him to say, yeah, Mark, give you a few minutes. That's awesome, and we appreciate that because he certainly did not have to do it. But this program is growing in significance and popularity across the state, and we appreciate you listening and telling your friends and family about what matters in North Carolina. We're going to take a quick break, and we will be right back. And you are on the Freedom Action Network. And on the other side, we'll talk some more about microaggressions, my favorite new topic. We'll be right back.
Wealth finance special interests are raking in big dollars by robbing hardworking North Carolinians. Thanks to government mandates pushing green energy in our state, electricity prices are going up, while reliable energy production doesn't keep up with demand. But it's not just lobbyists and well-connected green cronies doing Greedy Energy's dirty work. Republicans and Democrats alike are forcing households and businesses to pay more for unreliable energy, just to fatten the wallets of rich renewable energy investors. For example, radical environmentalists set up fake conservative front groups in North Carolina to hide the source of money behind its radical renewables campaign. And our politicians are falling for it. These efforts are being bankrolled by left-wing environmentalists like the Sea Change Foundation and the Energy Foundation, who have a political interest in pushing their extreme agenda. These radical organizations are headquartered in San Francisco and funnel millions of dollars from wealthy donors to influence elected officials in our state. It's time for our elected officials to stop the backroom deals with powerful radical environmentalists and protect North Carolina families and businesses from ever-increasing electricity bills. To learn more, visit ncenergycrooks.com.
What time is it? Well, it's either time for a beer or time to turn on the Free to Brew podcast. Just like your color TV and the internet, craft beer is not going away anytime soon. Tune in to the show for a free market perspective on the latest in beer news, regulations, and why the brewing industry has more to do with North Carolina politics than you realize. We tackle the distribution cap, taxes, food trucks, labeling, packaging, and anything I can possibly get away with. Try out the latest podcast on your drive home today. That's the Free to Brew Show with me, your host, Greg Polsher. At the end of the day, you can't have beer without liberty, and you can't have liberty without beer.
Welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver. So nice to see that Governor McCrory has awarded the Order of the Longleaf Pine to Senator Stan Bingham and also to Senator Bob Rucho. And we appreciate the work that those two senators have done. Very well deserving of the state's highest award to someone for public service or community service or civilian service, so to speak. So tip of the hat to Senator Rucho and Senator Bingham. And as I predicted, Senator Tillman did make a comment, and let's see here. Senator Tillman said that as they were being presented with the Longleaf Pine Awards, Senator Tillman said that Governor McCrory did not sign their certificate. So you can always count on Senator Tillman for a little comic relief in the Senate chamber. Well, it looks like the biggest thing that the education elite now has on their plate, and we were talking about this earlier, is microaggressions. And what is a microaggression? Well, it's something that the education elite has come up with to try to harness speech, to try to harness what comes out of our mouths in the form of words. And the University of North Carolina, their faculty forum, somebody posted a blog on there that the university initially distanced itself from, and they were saying that you need to be careful and make sure you don't say things like complimenting on a female coworker on their new shoes. Because in so doing, you are insulting that female coworker and basically letting them know that they are of really no value intellectually, but that the only thing that they're good for is a nice pair of kicks. Now, also, don't tell people, you know, that you enjoyed a round of golf because, you know, most people can't afford to play golf. And don't say Merry Christmas because you might offend somebody that's not a Christian. And on it goes. Well, the university said this wasn't our doing. This was not an official memorandum of policy. But what is so funny is it's been announced that they're going to have a Thinkposium. I don't know what that is, but I think it's where a bunch of education elitists get together and try to come up with more idiocy. Because this is going to be about microaggressions. And I wrote about this in an article entitled Hacking Away at the First Amendment. And I said, even though they distanced themselves from this particular post, they weren't done. And lo and behold, here we are finding out that they are not done. They are having a Thinkposium where they're going to talk about these issues and how you can apply them to your workplace and blah, blah, blah. And what it is another example of the elitist education establishment, the left, the militant left, trying to harness our speech, trying to make us talk a certain way, make us think a certain way. And this is wrong. We have a First Amendment, and it guarantees freedom of speech. We have a First Amendment, and it guarantees freedom of religion. And yet these people envision a society that is godless and that is controlled to the degree even what comes out of our mouth is regulated. So I guess if you want to be somebody that works at the University of North Carolina, if they have their way with this microaggression nonsense, you won't be able to say anything to anybody. You know, I like to pay compliments to people. I tend to be, you know, that kind of outgoing personality. So, you know, if I worked there and, you know, I would just have to put tape on my mouth because I couldn't say to someone, wow, that's an awesome new sweatshirt. What do you mean, Mark? You think I'm stupid? You like my sweatshirt? That's all I'm good for? You don't think I have a brain? You think I'm a moron? What did you mean by saying I have a nice sweatshirt? And then I'd probably be sued and lose my job. So this whole thing is stupid. I don't like to use that word, but it is stupid. And folks, I'm telling you on a serious note that you better stand up and take notice when people like me talk about these things, because they are coming after your mouth. They are coming after your Bible. They are coming after your right to talk about what's in your Bible. And if you don't think that they are, then you had better start thinking a little bit more clearly and seriously about what these people envision. They envision a world where your speech is controlled and where you cannot express your faith. You cannot talk about your faith. You cannot say something that is based in your faith that might offend or otherwise contradict the lifestyle choices that those people who would like to see this kind of world exist are making. You cannot say anything about the sanctity of marriage or the sanctity of human life. You cannot say anything about the, you know, foundations of our society. That is what they envision. That is what is coming down the highway at a great rate of speed and ready to just bowl over the entire First Amendment when it comes to people of faith, people of reason, and people that don't think that men should be in the showers with little girls. And if you're not concerned, please stop and check yourself and get concerned, because it is serious stuff. You're listening to What Matters in North Carolina here on the Freedom Action Network. And coming up, we've got Brian Balfour. He's going to go through the budget for us with some little known numbers that you might not have heard about. And that is next here on What Matters in North Carolina.
Fox News Radio.
I'm Lisa Brady. The U.S. defense chief says the reality is that transgenders are already serving in the U.S. military.
They've deployed all over the world, serving on aircraft, submarines, forward operating bases, and right here in the Pentagon.
Now they'll be able to serve openly. Fox Radio's Grinnell Scott has this live.
Lisa, Defense Secretary Ash Carter says the ban is lifted immediately, and transgender individuals will be actively able to enlist in the ranks a year from now. He says that will add to transgender numbers who wear the uniform today.
Although relatively few in number, we're talking about talented and trained Americans who are serving their country with honor and distinction.
The process includes getting medical care to establish gender identity by October. Carter announced last year that the ban would be lifted, Lisa.
Thanks, Grinnell. The White House says the U.S. Attorney General knows how to be impartial. This amid controversy over what's being called an impromptu meeting between Loretta Lynch and former President Bill Clinton on his private jet at a Phoenix airport Monday, even as Hillary Clinton's emails remain under federal investigation.
I did not attend the meeting, but Attorney General Lynch did, and she's spoken directly to how the meeting came about and what was discussed.
White House spokesman Josh Earnest. Lynch says she did not discuss any matters pending for the department. The U.S. State Department just confirming that a 13-year-old Israeli girl fatally stabbed in her bedroom in the occupied West Bank today was a U.S. citizen, the assailant climbing a security fence and entering that home. Late word from Hershey that its board has unanimously rejected a takeover bid from Oreo maker Mondelez. Hershey also saying there's no basis for further discussion. Hershey shares had been soaring on word of that offer. An hour to the close, Wall Street going for three in a row. The Dow is up 220 points. Fox News Radio, fair and balanced.
Real experience, real insight.
We're following this explosive story.
Nothing gets by Greta. Then.
This is all BS. What was that all about?
There's no spin and no question. O'Reilly dominates. Plus, smart, sharp, and cutting edge.
It's the news of the day, but with a little heat.
Megan delivers. And Sean seals the deal with fearless talk.
What part of that are you understanding?
Most watched. Most trusted. Fox News Channel. There's more to Fox News Radio than meets the ear. Go behind the headlines and join the conversation on the hottest stories of the day on the Fox News Radio Facebook page. Be a part of the Fox News Radio Facebook fan community. Post comments and tell us your opinions. See behind-the-scenes photos and videos and post your reactions to the stories that matter to you. Click the like button on Facebook and connect with breaking news and features like Fox in the Fast Lane, House Call for Help, and more. Go to Facebook.com/Fox News Radio.
Security forces raiding neighborhoods in Istanbul looking for suspects linked to ISIS. There's still no formal claim of responsibility for the Tuesday attack at Ataturk Airport that's now blamed for at least 44 deaths. This as U.S.-led airstrikes pound ISIS targets in Iraq.
U.S. military officials tell Fox a series of airstrikes by American and Iraqi jets have killed nearly 250 ISIS fighters in the past 2 days. The strikes against ISIS in Iraq began 1 day after the Istanbul bombings. The strikes came as a convoy of ISIS fighters fled the city of Fallujah, located 40 miles west of Baghdad. Fallujah was the first city to fall to ISIS in 2014. 55 ISIS trucks in all were destroyed, killing hundreds of ISIS fighters south of town. U.S. and Iraqi airstrikes also destroyed over 100 ISIS vehicles east of Ramadi, killing scores of additional ISIS fighters. At the Pentagon, Lucas Tomlinson, Fox News.
A security scare at Joint Base Andrews that turned out to be a false alarm.
A person inside a medical building on base saw something and said something, prompting the false alarm. The person who called 911 was not aware two people with long guns outside the window were security personnel. The base was put on lockdown and employees were told to shelter in place. About an hour later, the all clear was given.
Fox Radio's Rachel Sutherland. Joint Base Andrews says given the nature of the call, it had to be treated as a real response. It was also on the opposite side of the base from where a planned active shooter drill was scheduled, which further led officials at first to believe it was a real-world situation. The nation's oldest full-time park ranger gets attacked and robbed in her own home. Police in Richmond, California say 94-year-old Betty Reed Soskin was punched in the face several times in a late-night attack Monday. Among the items stolen, a coin given to her by President Obama when she lit the national Christmas tree last year at the White House. Soskin works as an interpretive ranger at a Rosie the Riveter historic park in the Bay Area. Fox News Radio.
Welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver. Glad to have you listening today on this Thursday. Looking forward to the Independence Day weekend and holiday time. Hope you've got really good plans made. And of course, if you want to follow us and engage with us on Twitter, remember you can do that at What Matters NC. As always, it's a pleasure to sit down and chat with Brian Balfour. He's the Executive Vice President of the Civitas Institute here in North Carolina. Brian, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we are in the final days, supposedly, of the General Assembly's short session, and they came to an agreement a few days ago on the budget, and $22.34 billion, a 2.8% increase. Before we get into some specifics that we want to talk about that you have actually highlighted that may not be at the top of everybody's mind, your thoughts initially on the budget, the 2.8% increase?
Yeah, absolutely. I did find it a little bit curious. I know we had sat here actually on your show and talked earlier about how the House and Senate had agreed early on in the session of a total spending number of $22.2 billion, but then the final agreement, as you mentioned, $22.34 billion. So a little bump. I think part of that can be attributed to some unspent money in the current budget and to having a little bit more availability there. So they went ahead to allocate that in the budget. And you did mention the 2.8% year-over-year increase, and that that pretty much falls in line or under the restraint as if we had a TABOR, a Taxpayer Bill of Rights, or a Taxpayer Protection Amendment, which would tie the annual growth rate and spending to the population plus inflation. So that would fall under there. And but we do also want to keep in mind that is a $1.2 billion increase over 2 years. So, I mean, the budget continues to grow at a relatively healthy clip. And of course, a large part of that is just a reflection of growing revenues, the state's improving economy. So there's more revenues going to state government for them to include in the budget. And also one thing, and I know we can get into some other specifics coming up, but do want to highlight a still a fairly aggressive deposit, if you will, into the state's rainy day fund.
Right.
You know, a lot of concern about uncertainty in the economy over the next couple of years. You know, when is the next recession going to hit? So it's always good to have a lot socked away in that rainy day fund so the state can better weather the coming economic downturn.
Our guest is Brian Balfour. He is with the Civitas Institute. And Brian, before we get to specifics, on a matter of policy, as you were talking about the growth in the budget, you've always heard that it's hard to undo things when it comes to government, whether it be state government, federal government, especially federal government. It would seem that the state, as the budget continues to grow and grow and grow, that the idea of cutting, you know, wouldn't it blow everybody's mind if next year the budget were $20 billion and a decrease of 10%? I mean, those kind of things just never happen. They don't seem to be realistic. Are you concerned at all that it just keeps growing and growing and growing?
Oh, of course, absolutely. I mean, that's something I've spent years documenting, the long-term growth trends in the state budget. And when you look at the last 20, 30 years, in particular, you're looking at North Carolina state budget relative to the state's population growth, and the state budget is far, far outpacing any growth in population and inflation, for that matter, in the state. I mean, when you start breaking down, you know, just the size of the budget relative to the size of the state, it's been phenomenal. I think it's about three times the pace of population growth over the last 30 years the state budget has grown. That's even after adjusting for inflation. And there's some other numbers we can get into here momentarily if you'd like.
Yeah, let's talk about that. You wrote a piece that's at nccivitas.org, and it's entitled Three Numbers You Won't Hear About This Year's Budget. And the first number is $5.5 billion. Let's talk about that for a moment.
Yeah, well, $5.5 billion, that is the total state budget 30 years ago for the state of North Carolina.
Wow.
And you know, that's a pittance, if you will, compared to the dollars we're talking about these days, but you know, $22+ billion. And so that's just, again, trying to draw things into perspective of just how much the state government and the state budget has grown just in the last 30 years. I mean, you know, for folks like me, 30 years wasn't all that long ago anymore.
Yeah, exactly. It sure doesn't feel like it. Well, and you address in your next point in your article, my initial thought was, well, Brian, you know, the state has been growing, the population has increased, but you sort of address that. Well, you address it head on in your next point.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, you know, the state has been growing and people can say, well, of course, the state budget is going to grow because we're such a growing state population wise and everything. Well, okay, let's adjust for that then. Let's look at the per capita spending. You know, how big is the current state budget per person, and even, of course, adjusting for inflation, you know, the value of the dollar declining over decades. But even after you adjust for all those, the state budget is still spending 42% more per person with the state budget than it was that mark 30 years ago.
Wow.
So 42%. That's, you know, every man, woman, and child in North Carolina is now having 42% more of their tax dollars being spent by the state government and the general fund. And that does not pull into play the federal dollars that's passed through to the state of North Carolina, which in recent years, especially the last, I would say probably 10 to 15 years, has been rapidly increasing. So the amount of money controlled and being dispensed by the government, either just directly through state tax dollars or pass-throughs from the federal government, has been increasing at a dramatic clip when you look at the last two, 3 decades especially.
Well, I think, as you point out, that this is a key point. You know, we often hear folks on the left and the progressives and liberals say, you know, this budget is bare bones. This budget is, you know, not spending enough. But I mean, 42% more per person compared to 30 years ago. You can't even make that argument with a straight face.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, 30 years ago, that's you know, the mid-80s. So it's not like government was really tiny and just, you know, doing a few core functions of public safety and that sort of thing. I mean, it was already, you know, had expanded at a pretty good clip by the 80s. And you just take that and ratchet it up even further. And here we are, you know, 42%, again, increase per capita spending that much more. And again, not even accounting for the additional federal dollars that are flowing in, which would make those numbers even more exaggerated.
Our guest here on What Matters in North Carolina is Brian Balfour. He is the Executive Vice President of the Civitas Institute. And What Matters in North Carolina certainly revolves a lot around our tax dollars and how they are being spent. And Brian has written an excellent piece that's posted at nccivitas.org. You can read it, called Three Numbers You Won't Hear About This Year's Budget. And the third number. Now, this really, really, I had no idea this number was what it was, but you say 2/3 or 66%. What does that represent?
Yeah, well, people, you know, they're always, a big question is, well, where does the money go? You know, the state budget, we're spending $22.3 billion. Where does it go? Well, one way to look at it is, well, the X amount goes to education, X amount goes to the HHS and public safety and so forth. But another spin I try to put on that to put things in perspective is 2/3, as you mentioned, about 66% of the general fund spending is devoted to state worker salary benefits and retiree pensions.
Whoa.
And benefits. And in dollar amounts, that's about $14.5 billion. That's just paying the state workers and retiree benefits.
Hmm.
And so if you want to look at, you know, when in reality we're talking about trying to rein in the state spending growth or even cutting back on spending, I mean, that's really the heart of what we're spending our money on in terms of state tax dollars and the general fund is the personnel, the benefits, the pension benefits, the health benefits. I mean, especially I've been writing about retiree health benefits. We've got, I think it's a ballpark about $25 billion unfunded liability for promised state health plan benefits for retirees. I mean, that's a huge ongoing recurring commitment that we have. Same thing with pension liabilities. That continues to grow. These are things that are promised that must be paid. They're going to chew up a larger share of the state budget moving forward, and I think it's really important to be addressed.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, the difficult thing is, you were just sharing that information, Brian, that I thought of would be, let's go back a couple of years when the General Assembly and Dale Falwell had stepped in over at Employment Security to try to turn that operation around. They had to make some really tough calls. They shortened the benefit period and they did away with automatic seasonal folks or like construction folks that if it rains, they automatically were plugged into the unemployment system. now they have to apply like everybody else. And so they made some tough calls. That's my point. And as this number begins to grow, it's already at two-thirds. At some point, the General Assembly is going to have to make some tough calls. Now, whether those calls would be a decrease in the number of state employees or a decrease in the amount that they pay for health insurance for employees and or retirees, those things will not be popular.
Yeah, absolutely. They are going to be tough decisions. And one thing, too, that would be an option out there to address specifically the pension liabilities would be to convert state employees to a 401k style retirement plan, which people put in. It's defined contributions rather than defined benefits. Currently, the state employees, when they retire, they have, what's called a defined benefit package where it's you're guaranteed this is the amount of money that you're going to get once you retire, based off the salary you earned during your career. That's really difficult to keep up those benefits because they keep increasing year after year as the pool of retirees grows, salaries, people, of course, we hear stories of people spiking their salary at the end of their careers with state government to try to increase that pension, and taxpayers are on the hook for a growing tab to pick that up.
Well, it certainly is something that has to be addressed because, it's already two-thirds, as you pointed out, of the entire budget, general fund. I mean, that's crazy, $14.5 billion. So looking now at the other more obvious parts of the budget that we've been hearing about, and the big issue was teacher pay raises, state employee pay raises, retiree cost of living adjustments. The governor in the House rolled out their proposals. The Senate had this robust teacher pay raise plan, which we all knew good and well they were not going to implement. But they came to a compromise, which for teachers doesn't seem to be a bad deal, an average of 4.7% and 1.5% for state employees. Are you comfortable with that? Does that seem reasonable?
It did seem to, the Senate went out there and, as you mentioned, set some pretty aggressive goals, and they actually don't fall very short of those. To be honest, average teacher pay, they're looking at bringing that up over $50,000 in the next school year, and up to nearly, their goal is to bring that up to nearly $55,000 in 3 years. Again, getting back to the expenses, that 66% of the state budget, these are going to be recurring commitments. So I think there's a bit of a concern, whether or not you think teachers deserve that sort of raise or what have you. We need to look at the math. I mean, just look at the numbers of how much, how we're ratcheting up that recurring budget, that baseline budget of commitments. Going forward, I mean, where are we going to cut when the next recession comes? Yeah, we've got the rainy day that's being built up, and that's very helpful and very prudent. But someday there are going to need to be some cuts made, and really, if you're going to make any sort of significant cutbacks when recession hits and the revenues fall, it's unavoidable that cutbacks are going to fall on personnel.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, our guest is Brian Balfour here on What Matters in North Carolina. He is the Executive Vice President of the Civitas Institute. And retirees, I think they're going to get a one-time bonus and probably not real happy about that. I'm certain that they're glad to have something as opposed to nothing. But we've had Ross Haley from the State Employees Association on the program. Not really very happy when the Senate had nothing for retirees and state employees. But again, how long can the state continue to not do things like give retirees a cost of living adjustment and still remain popular? I guess we're getting into kind of a policy or election oriented type of a thought. But in your opinion, if you continue year after year to ignore a segment of the demographic, at some point they're going to not like you anymore.
Right.
And so, but on the other hand, as you said, the numbers don't lie. These are huge amounts of recurring money. So what's the answer? Do you have any thoughts on how to take care of those people that work for the state and retired and at the same time control cost?
Yeah. Just to put that in a little bit of perspective, just throw this number out there, $1.2 billion. That's how much taxpayers are paying to subsidize the pensions of state retirees, $1.2 billion. Mm. That has risen dramatically in the last decade. So, I mean, that again, that's something that needs to be addressed. And getting back to converting state employees to a 401k-style retirement plan, that way the employees themselves, they own that account. So they can have control over it when they retire. That's their money. And we can take the politics out of it. Now, you know, if we make that conversion, retirees wouldn't have to be dependent on the legislature and, you know, the fluctuations of the economy and revenue availability. It would be their account. They would own it. They would be able to invest it and control it as they best see fit. And we really kind of take the politics out of it.
Yeah, that's definitely a worthy idea. And, you know, most big companies, I have a friend that works at Bayer, which is a global behemoth all over the world. And they've gone away. They don't have a defined benefit program. I don't know of too many companies that still have that, because it is an ongoing, recurring, growing obligation that a lot of major corporations have just abandoned because they can't afford it. I mean, it's just the numbers. Again, right. You know, as you have a growing retiree population and you're guaranteeing them a certain dollar amount for the rest of their life, you know, eventually that pool of funds starts to run dry.
It's a growing demographic. And of course, with people living longer, that's people more and more years receiving those pension payouts. Obviously, great news, people living longer.
Yeah.
But again, it puts the financial pressure on these obligations.
Our guest is Brian Balfour of the Civitas Institute. Now, one part of the budget, Brian, that got a lot of negative press from our friends on the left was the Opportunity Scholarship Program. Lawmakers are setting aside a $34.8 million grant for need-based scholarships. Just before I ask you this, my thought when this program was first rolled out several years ago was that it was going to be fairly streamlined, but all of a sudden it has exploded. And do you think that's because there is a demand in the public to get out of traditional public schools and try and do better for their kids? Or is this just a conservative philosophy that has taken root and will continue to grow?
Yeah, well, I think in large part it's in response to the demand. I mean, we saw when the Opportunity Scholarship Program, when it was started, I mean, the folks, the families and the students applying for these scholarships far outweighed the availability of the scholarships. So, you know, and we have such a growing waiting list here in North Carolina of these children that are just, their families are just desperate for another option relative or compared to what they are, what their children are in right now in the traditional public schools. So, yeah, I think so much of this, especially that aggressive goal, I mean, their goal, they stated, is to add 20,000 more kids to this Opportunity Scholarship Program over the next 10 years. That's a really aggressive goal, and I think it's largely attributed to the extreme amount of demand that they have for these scholarships.
Our guest is Brian Balfour. He's the Executive Vice President of the Civitas Institute here in Raleigh. You're listening to What Matters in North Carolina on the Freedom Action Network. And we talked a couple of weeks ago, Brian, about the light rail funding. And really, I'm still scratching my head, and maybe you can shed some light on this. I don't know. But last year, in the final hour, I was down there at the General Assembly when they were doing this budget thing, and they put a $500,000 cap on the light rail project. Suddenly, the House removes that cap. The Senate removes the cap, but says it has to be up to 10% of the cost of the project is how much the state will get on the hook for. Do you have any notion why they couldn't just leave the cap alone and why they feel like they have to be dipping into the pool, so to speak, of light rail? Even though what they have in the budget is not going to really promote that project along any faster, there seems to be a change in philosophy.
Yeah, well, some of the feedback that I've kind of heard, you know, secondhand, admittedly, but in terms of repealing that cap, but keeping that limit of 10% state support for the whole total cost of the project. The thing that you didn't mention is that these light rail projects, specifically the Durham-Orange County project that would impact the Triangle here specifically, is that these projects, these light rail projects, would go through the same process of any other transportation infrastructure project through the strategic transportation investment evaluation. So I think what they're doing is they're approaching this saying, hey, okay, we don't want to show any bias, you know, for or against light rail specifically. Let's put that project up, these rail projects up against other roads and highways and bridges, and we'll put it through this evaluation metrics of strategic transportation investment formulas, and we'll see which wins out, which we believe is the most urgent transportation need in the state, and then that's where the dollars will flow.
Well, that makes sense, I guess, but those in the Durham and Orange County areas were really kind of hoping to get that thing going, and it looks like it'll be a while now, at least based on the amount of money that the state is going to contribute. And I think you and I talked about this before. I'm not a person who would in any way bash public transportation. I think that it serves a need. I think I may have mentioned to you before that I've taken the city bus from Knightdale to downtown on many occasions when I worked at the General Assembly, and it's not a bad thing. But what I noticed, Brian, was that there were very few people on the bus, you know, me and maybe four or five others, and that would be going downtown or coming home. And so what it appears to me is that, and I'm sure around town there are a lot more people on the bus, but I don't think that the demand is there for public transportation, and I certainly don't think it would be there for light rail. Do you disagree, or do you feel
like
that's...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Light rail in particular just absolutely does not pass the market test. You're talking about demand. If there was truly demand for light rail projects, there would be private entrepreneurs lining up to provide that service to people.
Yeah.
I mean, look at when we're talking about transportation and innovation and transportation needs. I mean, look at Uber. Look at how that has absolutely exploded because it's filling a need. It's providing affordable and convenient transportation options for people versus light rail, which is terribly inefficient, mm-hmm. Wildly expensive, especially relative to laying down highway additional highway miles and lanes and so forth. So you know, there's really, you know, light rail just simply would not exist in its current form if not for government subsidies, taxpayer subsidies, and that just tells you, I think that just speaks volumes in terms of the inefficiency, that there are no private investors just seeking these sort of investment opportunities without these massive taxpayer subsidies.
Our guest is Brian Balfour. Brian, something that really makes me frustrated, and I think this would fall under the category of ridiculous in the budget, was last year there was an effort to try to put produce in convenience stores. And now our tax dollars are going to be spent. Apparently the Senate agreed to spend $250,000 on a program which would provide $6,000 grants to install refrigerators in convenience stores. This is, to me, if I own a convenience store and I want to sell produce, I should purchase my own refrigerator. There are refrigerators in most convenience stores that house soft drinks and beer and excuse me, milk and that sort of thing. So why in the world is the state spending tax money on something like this? And before you answer, I honestly don't think that the demand for fresh vegetables at the convenience store is going to be that great. Now, I may be wrong, but you know, when I go inside, I'm buying a drink or maybe a pack of nabs, and I'm out the door. People go in, they buy gas, they buy cigarettes, they buy beer. I don't think people are going, wow, I think I'm going to stop up here at the fast fair for a cucumber. So, I mean, this just seems ridiculous.
Right. And this, you know, this is something that's come up in the last several legislative sessions. In fact, I've categorized this when it was introduced legislatively. I wrote it up as a bad bill of the week.
Yeah.
Not that long ago. And it's really addressing the term they like to use as a food desert.
Yeah.
You know, where people are miles and miles from the nearest grocery store or retail outlet that's going to sell fresh fruit or vegetables. But as you mentioned, I mean, if there was a demand in these areas, the people looking for these products than the outlets would provide them.
Absolutely.
And I think that the legislators and the government in general needs to really pay attention to these market signals. I mean, if people are not going into these corner stores and convenience stores to look to buy, you know, ingredients for a fresh salad, why should taxpayers then subsidize these stores to offer products that people don't want to buy at that location anyways?
Yeah.
It's far beyond the scope of any sort of proper role of government and use of our taxpayer dollars.
Absolutely. I agree with that 100%. And I think that if we look down the road after this money is spent and these refrigerators are installed, it's likely that they will be installed with more beer or more soft drinks.
Well, yeah, then there's the cost of the monitoring, the program. There's going to have to people that are going to inspect these stores to make sure the refrigerators are being used for the use that the grant, you know, money was designed for. And that's just additional costs. And getting back to the personnel, hiring additional personnel into the state government payroll.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really surprised, frankly, that the Senate went along with this because they tend to be more financially prudent and conservative. So they must have gotten something in return that we may not know about in order to cave on this. Brian, is there anything else you'd like to point out before we wind up our time together about the budget?
Sure. Well, just one thing real quickly. It's not necessarily tucked into the budget itself, but a reminder for folks getting ready probably to travel for 4th of July, the gas tax. As of July 1, the gas tax is going to drop a penny.
Okay.
Because of legislation passed last year. But that legislation that set the gas tax at 34 cents a gallon actually was establishing a floor. The way the gas tax in North Carolina is set up is adjustable along with the rate of the price of wholesale gasoline. So we had that stretch where gas prices were pretty cheap for a while.
Right.
So if not for this legislation passed, the gas tax would have dropped several cents even lower on July 1st. So just kind of keep that in mind as you're filling up the tank for your travels this holiday weekend, that the gas tax could have been still cheaper than if not for this legislation that was passed this last session.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's probably a topic that we could spend another whole segment on, and perhaps we will do that in the future. Why is North Carolina's gas tax so high? Brian Balfour, we appreciate it. You are the Executive Vice President from the Civitas Institute, doing a great job there, and as always, a great job in your visit here on What Matters in North Carolina.
All right, thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you.
Radio, Elisa Brady. The U.S. defense chief is lifting the military's transgender ban, calling it the right thing to do, but also citing recruitment needs. Fox Radio's Gernal Scott has this live.
Elisa, Defense Secretary Ash Carter says aside from bolstering our future fighting force, allowing transgender individuals to enlist is in line with principles of freedom.
Americans who want to serve and can meet our standards should be afforded the opportunity to compete to do so.
It will take a year to change the policy, but Senate Armed Services Chairman John McCain told Fox News he wants to talk to commanders about what it will take.
I'm talking about the physical costs of implementing some of these changes.
McCain says he intends to hold hearings on the matter as well, Lisa.
Thanks, Gernal. 2 days after the triple suicide attack in Turkey, reassurance from the Homeland Security chief about U.S. airport security.
Since the Brussels attack in March, our TSA Viper teams have been more visible at airports and at transit centers generally.
Secretary Jay Johnson also urging the public to be vigilant at public events this holiday weekend, but not to curtail any plans. Turkish officials say those three suicide attackers who killed at least 44 people at Istanbul's airport on Tuesday were not from Turkey. They were from Russia, Uzbekistan, and Kyrgyzstan. Raids in Istanbul rounding up over a dozen people with suspected ties to the attackers, 9 others suspected of links to ISIS, have been detained. Donald Trump back in New Hampshire, which gave him his first win in the primaries.
All of my life I watch politics, and New Hampshire has that special ring to it. And also for the people of New Hampshire, you know there's big movement to move you to the back of the pack. Trump wins, that's not happening. I can guarantee you. I can guarantee you that.
Speaking moments ago in Manchester, Wall Street rallies again, the Dow up 235 at the bell. Fox News Radio, fair and balanced.
Republicans, the Democrats, two critical conventions, and only one network covers it all. Fair and Balanced, Fox News Channel, starting July 18th, the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, Ohio. Then, starting July 25th, the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The must-see political events are on Fox News Channel. We are America's election headquarters.
Your side has been desperately
wrong. He continues not to tell the truth.
It's got
to
be a
problem. All thing is a mess.
Let me make this point.
Nobody can justify this.
If I ask a question, I want an answer.
Another crazy school district.
Reaction from both sides.
What's the beef from the left?
Do you not see the danger?
Not a fact.
No.
That's
no,
what a pinhead says.
No BS, no fluff. Straight up facts.
Straight talking. Skin stopping. Calling out the pinheads and calling it like it is.
Please watch the O'Reilly Factor weeknights on the Fox News Channel.
An American contractor now formally charged with rape and murder in Japan, where he works at a U.S. airbase.
Former U.S. Marine Kenneth Shinzato charged with the rape and murder of a young woman on Okinawa in a case that has led to a spike in anti-U.S. tensions here. Protesters denouncing what they see as high crime rates that come with Japan having to host U.S. military bases. In fact, U.S. commanders here say crime levels are low, and when offenses occur, they respond. After this incident, they imposed a curfew and a no-partying rule for troops in Okinawa. There'll be no July 4th fireworks on bases here this year. In Tokyo, Alistair Wanklin, Fox News.
Police in New Jersey now say a high school student who struck and killed her district's school superintendent and his dog while he was jogging was talking on her cell phone at the time. Mercer County prosecutors charging the girl, who's now 18, with death by auto and leaving the scene of an accident. She was 17 at the time in April and charged as a juvenile, also receiving citations for improper use of a cell phone. Californians are on their fifth year of drought, which continues to fuel wildfires. That's not the only danger.
Some animal control experts and fire officials here in California get more calls during the summertime to come handle rattlesnakes. Jason Gilroy with Southern California Snake Removal is booked for the next month and a half to build fencing around people's property lines to keep snakes out, especially around homes with pools.
They're just like coming out of their areas and they're basically braving it, coming down onto people's properties just to get that water and then leave again. They're just working their way towards people because that's where the life is, because where they live, there's no more streams, there's no more puddles of water, there's no more drinking sources.
He says getting bitten by a snake is extremely expensive, and hospital bills, including anti-venom medication, can run people well over $100,000. Jessica Rosenthal, Fox News.
Again, Wall Street, third big rally in a row, the Dow closing up 235. Fox News Radio.
In my mind, I'm gone, Carolina.
Welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver. Always a pleasure to have the Speaker of the North Carolina House of Representatives, Tim Moore, with us. Speaker Moore, welcome back.
Thanks, Mark. Good to be with you today.
Well, I know that you and your colleagues over at the House are extremely busy, so we're very grateful for you taking a few moments to be with us. It appears that you and the Senate, the House and the Senate, have compromised and come together and made an agreement on the budget, and the House is going to be debating that. Can you tell us how that process went? Because frankly, Mr. Speaker, last year there was a lot of talk and a lot of going back and forth, but this year it seemed pretty quiet. It sounds like it was a much more amiable process, as it were.
Well, the budget negotiations were really went very well. We have a budget we can all be very proud of. It lowers taxes. It grows less than what's called the Tabor numbers. In other words, that it grows at a rate less than inflation, population growth, and those factors. It funds teachers. It gives teachers the largest pay raise in many years. It gives pay raises to hardworking state employees. It gives a bonus to retirees. And it does so while at the same time cutting taxes. And what we have seen is that our efforts to cut taxes and to cut regulation these last few years since the Republican majorities is paying huge dividends, because we're now seeing more revenue come in with lower taxes, just like President Reagan did in the 1980s and we saw carry into the 1990s. If you lower taxes and you unleash the potential of the free market system, it allows everyone to prosper.
Well, certainly can't argue with you there. The work that the General Assembly has done in the last 6 years has been outstanding, and the leadership that you and Senator Berger are providing, particularly in these matters of fiscal prudence, is really something that is to be admired and appreciated by the citizens of North Carolina. Our guest is Speaker Tim Moore here on What Matters in North Carolina. And the budget turned out to be $22.34 billion, slightly more than the previously agreed to amount. Is that a big deal, or just that's the way it worked out?
That's just the way it worked out. We had some money in reserve to address differences between the two budgets, and so we allowed that as a buffer, knowing that there would be some priorities that were not funded in one budget or another, so that contingency allowed us to do that. And some of the things that were funded as a result of that were the new airplane for the State Bureau of Investigation. There was some money used for education improvements, for infrastructure improvements and clean water and sewer grants, some downtown revitalization grants, a lot of things that are going to create jobs and that are a wise use of taxpayer money.
Well, I think that that is certainly something that you guys can be characterized as, and that is spending the state's money wisely. I mean, after all, when the Republicans took the majority, you guys walked into a $3 billion deficit. So it's nice to know that our state is nowhere near that kind of mess. But our guest is Speaker Tim Moore here, Speaker of the North Carolina House of Representatives. And Mr. Speaker, do you feel good about the teacher pay raise, 4.7%, getting the average pay up over $50,000? That's got to be a strong positive in this budget.
It's tremendously positive. What we wanted to do in this budget was to make sure that teachers are paid well. And so while I think we still have some work to do, this is a great effort. These are huge strides that have been made to making sure that we do adequately pay our teachers and other state employees. You know, I'm not only a House member, I'm a parent of two sons who are students in the public schools back in Cleveland County. And so I interact with our teachers, and of course, my children are their education that they're getting to prepare them for the future is dependent in so many ways on the quality of education they're getting. So I and many of my members are in the same boat as most people out there. We count on our schools to educate our kids, and that strong fundamental education is critical to a good future. So we want to make sure we have good teachers who are paid a good salary, because I think you can draw a nexus between quality of teachers and the quality of students that come out of the schools.
Absolutely. Our guest is Speaker Tim Moore here on What Matters in North Carolina, spending a few moments during a very busy day, and we are most grateful for that. Speaker Moore, the Opportunity Scholarship Program, frankly, when it first came out, I was working down there, and I thought, well, this is something that, you know, is probably going to be a pilot of sorts, and we'll see how it goes. But apparently, the demand for this program has really been strong. The budget setting aside nearly $35 million in grant money for need-based scholarships. Do you feel like this is an indication that people are really wanting to move out of, you know, what they might have previously experienced as an education environment that is not what they really feel is best for their kids, and take advantage of these opportunity scholarships? In other words, the demand really seems to be there.
There certainly is a great deal of demand for the opportunity scholarships. And what I think that shows is that, as I mentioned before, I'm a parent of two sons who are students in the public schools in Cleveland County. Very pleased. I'm very pleased with the level of education they receive and the quality that's there, and just overall just very pleased with the good job the teachers are doing and the education they're receiving. There are some areas in the state where perhaps the educational opportunities are not what those residents would like, where there are some challenges. And so what we have sought to do is to make sure that there are options available for parents, that parents have choices, whether it's in the form of charter schools or whether it's in the form of the opportunity scholarships, or more recently in the new bill that would allow for chronically failing school districts to be managed differently. We have tried to provide opportunities to make sure that students at the end of the day get the best education they can. Just as one size does not fit all in clothing, one size does not fit all in education. And as a result, we have sought to try to make sure that we have the best public education that we can, and at the same time to allow for opportunities for alternatives for those where that's best suited.
Well, Speaker Moore, the budget invests or sets aside another $475 million in the rainy day fund. You know, our friends on the left would probably rather you guys spent that money. But really, with all of the uncertainty around the world financially, those kind of things that triggered a recession in 2008 could sometime, maybe sooner than we think, you know, trigger another financial crisis. And so you guys are being pretty prudent by setting money aside.
Well, I concur completely. We, you know, just as a family, always when you can, you want to have a savings to pay for unintended expense, or not unintended, but unforeseen expenses. In this case, we want to have a strong savings and reserve fund or a rainy day fund to buttress against economic downturn, natural disaster, you know, things that may even be unforeseen that would result in a need for new funds in the state treasury. So it's very important that we don't spend every dime that we have. So we've been very prudent with the taxpayers' money. We're going to continue to do that. And one would only hope that Washington would take cues from the state of North Carolina and from other states. You know, part of the problem now that our economy has is that Washington is constantly on a spending spree.
Yes,
they can just print money and do whatever. Well, if the state, we can't do that. We can't go into debts and we can't have deficit spending. And as a result, we make the tough decisions. We avoid the deficits. And since the Republicans have been in charge, you have seen, in the last couple of years now, budget surpluses. But I would tell you this too, Mark. Not only are we spending more wisely, are we spending less, but we're taxing less, both in terms of actual taxes and in terms of the regulatory costs. And that, I would submit, is a very large part of why North Carolina is actually doing as well as it is.
Absolutely. Speaker Tim Moore, our guest here for a couple more moments on what matters in North Carolina. One thing that is kind of a disconcerting as far as a future long-term outlook, I was reading that nearly two-thirds of the state budget is devoted to the general fund is worker salaries, state employee salaries, benefits, retiree pensions and benefits. And that number would probably just get larger as more and more people retire. So how do you balance that with the demand or request or, you know, plea from state employees and retirees to, you know, boost their income, boost their salary? I know that state employees got, I think, a 1.5% raise and the retirees got a one-time bonus. But it's going to be hard, Speaker Moore, to continue to meet the need of that growing demographic when it's already at two-thirds of the general fund.
Well, you know, pension reform at some point is going to be something the General Assembly is going to have to take up. The growth models to ensure that the present retirement system fully funds the retiree benefits assumes an annual growth rate of 7.25%. Well, the state retirement system is not seeing that kind of growth at all, anywhere near that. Mm-hmm. So there are a number of proposals out there right now as to how you reform the state retirement system and the pension fund. And they're not, you know, frankly, they're no easy options. But it is something we're going to have to deal with. We also have a huge future unfunded liability that we're going to have to deal with when it comes to the state health plan. It is, for many years, folks were able to get full benefits on the health plan by working 5 years, then leaving and going elsewhere. That has been changed since. But there are many folks who will be coming on the state health plan once they reach retirement age, who only work for the state for, say, 5 years. And, you know, and there's going to be a lot of cost to that. Now, we fixed it several years ago ongoing, but, you know, those benefits where they vested are going to cost a lot of money.
Yes.
So we're going to be forced to make tough decisions at some point. And I think that's going to be very important that we have collaboration from all the stakeholders, that we get a lot of folks involved. And I would expect in the next couple of years, you'll see discussion along those lines. I mean, you look at states where, I think it was maybe Detroit, that filed bankruptcy due in large part to their city pension fund. I mean, this is a problem in some states and some areas that have pension funds where, you know, they would just keep kicking the can down the road, never address with it, never do anything, till the situation got so critical and so bad there was nothing they could do.
Yeah.
It's like treating a disease. If you detect cancer early enough and you do something about it, you got a good chance to survive it. But if you detect cancer and just kind of ignore it and hope it'll go away, usually it doesn't work out really well. And that's, you know, and I think when it comes to problems that we see in any kind of fiscal or governmental agency, when you see there's a problem, at some point you have to deal with it.
Well, absolutely. I would agree with you wholeheartedly. Before we go, Speaker Moore, is there anything about the budget that you particularly, I don't want to put you on the spot, but did you really, really like? I mean, I know you probably like the teacher pay raises and raising the average pay, but anything that you could point your finger at and go, yeah, you know, this was really good. This is something good that we did.
Well, I like the significant tax cuts in the budget. I mean, we have increased what's called the 0% tax bracket, where more money earned by North Carolinians is completely free from tax. And that's going to help. I mean, while everybody enjoys it as a percentage, that helps the poorest. That helps the poorest among us who, with the cost of gas and cost of other necessities are going to be helped the most. So I'm probably most proud of the tax cuts that we passed. But then again, as you mentioned, I'm very pleased with the teacher pay increase. I'm very pleased with the money we've put into economic development, to the pay increases for the state employees and retirees. I mean, I think overall it is a very good package, and I expect a very, very strong vote to pass the budget.
Well, Speaker Tim Moore, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to keep telling everybody I know that what you're doing and talking about the zero-based tax bracket is actually raising the standard deduction. And the people on the left want to blast on social media that all this does is help millionaires. But when more than two-thirds of North Carolinians do not itemize but take that standard deduction, just like me, that is a benefit that I personally receive. And also, talking about lowering the cap or maximum amount of income tax, you know, it's just stupid to say that all that does is help millionaires when it helps folks just like me and others who are out here working every day and paying their taxes. So I'll keep spreading that message, and you keep just providing excellent leadership, and I think we'll be okay.
Well, thank you, Mark. I certainly wish you the best, and certainly wish you a great 4th of July.
Yes, sir. Thank you. You too, sir. Thank you, Speaker Tim Moore.
Thank you. Take care.
Well, there he is, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, and so glad that he is a friend of the show, and he took time before going into the budget debate. We were able to pre-record a segment with him, and so we appreciate that very much. And I think the budget is pretty good. I think it's real good, actually. The teachers are getting a nice raise. And now we play the game, what will the liberals complain about now? And we have choices. A, the raise wasn't big enough. B, the raise wasn't big enough. Or C, the raise wasn't big enough. Let me tell you something. The left will complain. Actually, what they'll probably do is they'll find something else to complain about. since the teacher raise was pretty good. And they'll complain about teacher assistants not getting a raise, or not enough textbooks, not enough digital learning materials. Because, folks, one thing that I have learned in my years of working at the General Assembly, working for the Senate chairman of the Education Committee, and listening to people come in and lobbyists and advocates come in, one thing I have learned is that it is primarily about money. In covering the General Assembly as a member of the media, I have learned one thing, and that is, well, I've learned more than one thing, but I have learned that it's money. It's all about the money. Money, money, money. And you look over there at that large Department of Public Instruction building, and you have to ask yourself, what the heck are they doing with all the money? Remember, we've talked on here at length, ad nauseum, about children not being able to read at grade level, and students graduating. And lo and behold, here's community colleges and colleges saying, well, we have to teach remedial reading. And so I've often wondered and asked, and nobody's really been able to answer me, why kids are walking across auditorium stages getting diplomas and they cannot read at grade level. I do not understand that. And so the fact of the matter is that it is about money. It is about control. It is about keeping the status quo in place for as long as possible. Keep as much tax money flowing to the Department of Public Instruction as is possible. And then when you have flooded the Department of Public Instruction with billions, then do it again and continue to do it, and do it as often and as regularly and with increased amount as possible. The fact of the matter is that money is the primary concern of the education establishment. They want more. They cannot seem to be content. They cannot seem to make the money that they have go far enough. I mean, we hear that, we talked about the other day, somebody saying, one of these protesters, that, you know, there's no toilet paper. And look, folks, there's over $8 billion being sent to the local school districts in North Carolina. And if there's not enough toilet paper in a school, that is not the state of North Carolina's fault. That is not the General Assembly's fault. I've often said we should shine a little bit of a light, maybe a large light, on how the local school districts spend the money that they get from the state. But the concern is money. So the teachers have gotten a raise, and the elitist left, the militant left, the liberals will be out in force complaining about something else having to do with money from the General Assembly. They want as much as they can possibly get, and it is never, ever going to be enough. We'd like to thank House Speaker Tim Moore for joining us today. We'd like to thank Brenda Berg. Brenda Berg, she is the CEO of Best NC. Very pleasant interview with her about the education budget and what she sees going forward for education in North Carolina. Brian Balfour of the Civitas Institute, and of course our friend Nick Oxner from WBTV, who is working very hard even as we speak. Lots of great guests lined up for you tomorrow, and we cannot wait to get back at it once again. If you missed anything from Brenda Berg at 3 o'clock to Speaker Moore at 4:35, feel free to download the show as a podcast, freedomactionnetwork.com, or you can go to the iTunes Store, Google Play, whatever is your pleasure, and find us there. Well, we will be back tomorrow, heading into a long weekend, and we will look forward to getting together with you again then. Bye. Can't you just feel the moonshine? Ain't he just like a friend of mine? You hit me from
high, 'cause I'm gone to Carolina.